Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Labbitt today is Helen Crane. And coming up, the Bank of England holds again. So have interest rates peaked? When will they start to fall? And is there a glimmer of hope for first-time buyers? Also today, Crane is back on the case, helping a reader who found out they owed over $8,000 in driving fines after their name was spelt wrong. Plus, the best investment trusts of the past decade are now going cheap, and the luckiest premium bond winners of 2023. But who won the jackpot with the smallest holding? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, as widely expected, rates were held for the second meeting in a row at 5.25%. So, is that it? Have we peaked? And what does it mean for borrowers, savers, investors, and the wider economy? Simon, Helen, welcome. Simon first. Another hold. Why is that?
It's another hold. That's two meetings in a row after 14 rises in a row, which is quite some run of rate rises, if we're going to be entirely honest. Interest rates, historically speaking, at the moment at 5.25%, but that's an awful lot higher than the 0.1% that they started at. And if you take the order of magnitude with which interest rates have risen from that almost zero number to the 5.25% that they're at now, this is by far the biggest and fastest series of rate rises that we've ever seen in this country. The question on many people's minds is, has all of the effect of this filtered through? People have been increasingly asking that question. The Bank of England appeared to be largely ignoring that question as it kept raising interest rates. But in the last couple of meetings, it seems to have decided to pay a bit more attention to it. Also, it loves to say that it's dependent on the data. And the data coming through doesn't look amazing for the economy. It does look like things are starting to slow down. It's a little bit more slack in the labour market. That's one of the key things it's looking at. If you look at the money supply, that's shrinking. That's a kind of very old-fashioned way of looking at things, money supply, but it does matter. That's how much money is being created in the economy. Housing market, massively softened. Don't think it's really being shown in the official house price figures or any of the big mortgage lender figures yet. But if you look around, people are not able to sell houses at the moment for anywhere near the price they could do. And in fact, even when they cut the price, a lot of people are struggling to sell those houses. People are really struggling in their day-to-day living. They just don't have that spare cash that they had before. You've got people whose mortgage rates have gone up. There's only about 50% of the people who are going to face mortgage rate rises who've seen them so far, but that's enough for it to be making a difference. Some people are running through their savings in order to keep themselves afloat. Businesses as well. Let's not forget businesses. The cost of business borrowing has gone up substantially. This is being started to be reflected in businesses. You've got PMI numbers showing pretty dire figures for things like construction, house building, so on and so on. It all looks like the economy's softening, and it probably isn't the time to be raising interest rates again. Having said that, although yesterday we were looking at, I think, something like a 93% chance, according to the markets, that the Bank of England was going to hold, there was a 7% chance that they were going to raise. And we were prepared for the possibility of a surprise hike at This Is Money. You have to be prepared for every eventuality. We hadn't actually prepared for the possibility of a cut, but we were prepared for the surprise hike. And in fact, interestingly, it was 6-3, the vote. So 6 for a hold, 3 voted for a rise. So there were 3 members of the MPC who thought that we should raise rates. And it's really important to remember that something happened the night before as well, which is the US Federal Reserve also held rates for the second time in a row. Similar picture in the US, similar picture here. So, you know, that's why we've got the pause in rates. I mean, we're going to talk about whether it's the peak or not in a minute, aren't we?
Well, we are indeed, because Helen, when it all came out, I'm sure the same was with you. My email inbox went whoosh, with loads and loads of PR emails about what will happen next and what this means, and completely from one end of the spectrum to the other. The next one is going to be cuts, we've peaked, and the other one is like, you know, maybe actually no, we're going to get some more raises later on. Where they get that from is the minutes of the meeting, what the governor's been saying. What did he say?
Yeah, I think the consensus is looking at that report and also looking at sort of the forecasts that have been coming out in the last few weeks. Things have kind of changed quite significantly. So a couple of months ago, the forecast was saying that base rate would eventually peak somewhere around 6.5%. That's been quite substantially kind of dialed down. So a lot of people are now saying that we possibly are at the peak now. But as you said, that doesn't mean that things are going to start going down anytime soon. It seems to be like we've been in a period of quite a lot of change. It seems like now things are kind of petering out a little bit. So the base rate will probably stay around this level, I think, for quite some time. It's kind of good news in a way. At least it's not going up. But I think no one is expecting big cuts quickly. If you look at where inflation is, so in September, CPI inflation stayed at 6.7%, which is exactly where it was the month before. Some economists were predicting that it would go down. It didn't. So things are sort of starting to stall a little bit. You know, inflation has come down. You know, it was double digits until a few months ago. But I think we've hit a kind of sticking point where things aren't kind of changing as quickly. And we're going to have to kind of deal with this new sort of situation that we're in for quite some time. I think that the period of big changes is kind of gone, but that doesn't mean that things are going to start going down anytime soon.
Simon, just listening to you talk about the wasn't very optimistic state of economic affairs in this country, would the Bank of England, looking at this and the MPC, think this is exactly what we were after? Unemployment's still low, but it's going up. The economy is slowing down. Wasn't that the whole point of this? Raising interest rates very quickly to get a handle on inflation. I mean, that looks like Rishi Sunak's going to get at least one of his targets by the end of the year. So would they look back at this and think, not even look back at this, would they be looking at this situation now and think, that's what we wanted?
The Bank of England thinks Rishi might already be there, actually, because what's going to happen in the next set of inflation figures is you're going to see the energy price cap reduction kick in. And that should be enough, potentially, to drop inflation down, particularly as going against oil prices actually not been that robust. And there's been a slight kind of edging down in petrol prices recently from albeit a bit of a spike in recent months. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely. 100%. This is what the Bank of England was trying to do. They were trying to slow the economy. That is how rate rises work. I mean, the basic principle is that you raise the base rate, that makes the cost of funding more expensive for banks and building societies. They pass on a higher cost of borrowing to businesses and individuals, largely in the term of mortgages, but credit as well, car finance, for example. And then therefore, by raising the price of something, i.e. borrowing, you reduce the demand for it. When you reduce the demand for it, there's less of it. So there's less money being created by those banks and building societies when they hit a button and ping 200 grand into somebody's account for their new mortgage. And after a while, that all starts to take effect. The transmission method is a bit lumpy, though, nowadays, because loads of people have fixed rate mortgages. Whereas if you go back to the early 90s, most people have variable rate mortgages. So when people tell you about those double digit interest rates, which we've talked about many times, when you factor in the cost of houses now being that much more expensive, double digit interest rates then roughly equal to the 5% interest rates, 6% interest rates that we're seeing on mortgages now. But every time the Bank of England raised the base rate back then, people ended up almost immediately paying more money on their mortgage. There's not that many people doing that now. Standard variable rate borrowers are going to see their mortgages go up. Tracker rate borrowers are going to see their mortgages go up. But what happens now is people are protected until they come off their fixed rate. And then all of a sudden they get whacked around the head by a bill for hundreds of pounds a month more. Or if you're looking at the scenario where someone wants to move home, or somebody wants to be a first-time buyer or something like that. So it's quite lumpy how it hits. That has then led into the questions that have been asked many times of, is the Bank of England actually giving enough time for this to take effect before it keeps going and keeps going and keeps going? Or are we going to be playing catch up with this? And is actually the effect of this going to be much, much worse than the Bank of England thinks? The bank thinks it's got away with raising rates so quickly. We all think we've got away with it, but actually it's going to be much worse. And then we've seen this issue with the interest rate, sorry, the inflation panics that we've seen. We saw the Liz Truss mini budget interest rate panic. Then that ebbed away. Mortgage rates came this year. And then we had the summer inflation panic, the mortgage rate spike. They went up to incredibly high levels. Since then, lender competition has come back in and we've had mortgage rates going down again. So it's all a bit confusing as to how this is playing out. But the end goal of this scenario was slow the economy, reduce the amount of borrowing, encourage people to save a bit more, and bring down inflation that way. And also, it's not about the inflation number that you see right now. It's not about 6.7%. That inflation's in the past. We've already had that. Bank of England knows it can't do anything about that. It's about the inflation in the future. It's about stopping you thinking that inflation is going to be 6.7% this time next year. So you go out and you ask for more money. Your employer feels it has to pay you more money because the labour market is super tight and it can't get other people. And then in that scenario, you then start to get a wage price spiral, which in the economics textbooks that everybody was brought up with is such a scary, scary, scary monster that anybody has got anything to do with economics or central banking is absolutely terrified of it, even though there are questions as to whether, as with many things in economics, it actually plays out in the real world like it does in the textbooks. And also, there is a wider issue here, which is we need a rebalancing in the economy away from being a low wage economy to a higher wage economy. That was actually one of the stated aims of Boris Johnson's government when he came in. And it was one of the arguments that he put forward for, you know, some of the post-Brexit disruption in the jobs market and stuff, where people were saying, we can't get anybody to work in our cafes. And he's like, well, you're going to have to employ British people to work in your cafes and pay them more money. And then all of a sudden it swaps from being a good thing that people are getting paid more money to a bad thing. But ultimately, we do need to get back to a scenario where the old normal, where interest rates are at a normal level. They're not at a super, super low level. You know, half a percent is, you don't want to be at 0.5%. It causes all kinds of problems. It's totally banjacks the property market. It caused absolutely wild speculation. WeWork, in the process of going bust, basically at one point WeWork had completely disrupted the office and was worth a gazillion dollars. It hadn't. It was just a different take on serviced offices. And lo and behold, as interest rates went up, price of money went up, and the pandemic happened as well. That turned out to not be the case, and WeWork has sunk. But, you know, people were just chucking money at this stuff, and it was because interest rates were so low. We needed wages to be going up higher, faster than inflation. That's what used to happen in the old days regularly. We need real wage rises, and we need the base rate to be higher than inflation. So what you want is wages here at the higher level, base rate just below it, inflation below that. That's the situation you want to try to get yourself back into. Unfortunately, the world went so nuts for super cheap money post-financial crisis and then revived by the pandemic era stuff, that the readjustment back to that is really, really painful. And unfortunately, it's really, really painful for one chunk of society much more than others. And unfortunately, that's the chunk of society that hasn't really benefited from the major growth in asset prices. It's the younger bit of society. It's the people trying to move home, buy their home, trade up a family home, want to be a first-time buyer, paying rent, not with big savings, not with big investments. And actually, the people who are doing better off it are the people with all the money who tend to be older, wealthier, and so on. And so it is unfortunate that the readjustment involves the most pain being delivered to the people who didn't have the most in the first place.
Talking of those people, Helen, let's move over to the impact of this decision, this hold on. Let's go for mortgage borrowers, first of all. What is that going to mean for fixed rate mortgages now?
So in theory, it's good news, because if the base rate doesn't go up, mortgage lenders are unlikely to raise their rates in a substantial way. And we have seen quite a lot of cuts over the last few weeks to mortgage rates, partly in response to these predictions that the base rate won't perhaps go as high as people expected. However, I think the consensus is very much that we're not going to see any further big cuts to mortgage rates. So to the situation at the minute, the average two-year fix is 6.31%, the average five-year fix is 5.87%. However, you have to think of it in the way that, you know, a lot of people are on fixed rate mortgages, as Simon said. Some of those people will still be on rates of 2% that they fixed 2 years ago. So this is going to be a big jump in people's payments. You know, rates are kind of staying the same at the minute, but if you're coming off a rate of 2% to a rate of over 5%, you know, that could be hundreds of pounds a month. This is a situation we've been in for quite some time. It's good news that we probably won't see any big rises in average mortgage rates for a while, but it's this same situation we've been talking about for quite some time, in that as people roll off these fixed deals, they are going to still be having these kind of payment shocks. So we talked to some brokers, and Chris Sykes, who works with the broker Private Finance, he said it's a really positive message to lenders and borrowers that unless anything drastic changes, this is likely the peak of the base rate. It always inspires confidence in the market when the only way is down. That's true. But he went on to say, real question is when we'll see decreases. And I don't think anyone expects these until later next year. So I think the kind of consensus is that mortgage rates are going to stay broadly where they are until late 2024, at least, which is not good news for anyone having to lock in a new mortgage.
No, not at all. Simon, you mentioned there young people, you know, it's a tough time for first time buyers. You've got this unhappy situation of high mortgage rates and high house prices. And yes, we've seen them dip from last year, but they're still way above pre-pandemic levels. Is there any hope? We've got some analysis from Leeds Building Society saying over the next 5 years, over 400,000 fewer first time buyers will make it onto the housing ladder. Tell me more about that, will you?
Yes, the problem for first-time buyers for a long time has been raising a deposit. And actually, things have flipped around a bit now. And there's quite a few people that I'm talking to in that position who say, well, look, I'd actually managed to get to that deposit or near to it. But now the problem is the mortgage. I can't get the mortgage. And due to the rise in rates, you can't get the mortgage size that you previously could. And the impact of that can be quite substantial. For example, if you're looking at the average five-year fixed rate mortgage, people have got a limited deposit. They can't, you know, raise the unlimited deposit. They've got the same amount of money every month that they could pay before, because it's affordability-based lending. So it looks at your incomings and your outgoings. Potentially, you could be looking at being able to borrow £50,000 less. So you're going to need to pay £50,000 less for a property. Now, in theory, that would be good, paying £50,000 less for the property and borrowing less, because it's going to cost you less in the long run. The problem is finding somebody to sell you the same property for £50,000 less. Whilst the market is struggling and people are struggling to sell, unless somebody absolutely has to sell, what tends to happen is that they will just sit on their hands. And they won't cut their prices. And if you've got enough people not cutting their prices, then it doesn't put the downward pressure on the other prices. So we haven't seen prices come down in terms of enough stock with enough prices cut by a large enough amount to mean that first-time buyers are finding things balance out. But that doesn't mean that they should give up all hope. I would suggest that what it means is that, you know, they're going to have to work quite a lot harder to find the property that they want, but it's still possible. If you can find, for example, a buy-to-let landlord who wants to sell up and just wants to get out, for example, now it's quite likely that that landlord in that scenario is selling up for one of two reasons. One, they can't afford the mortgage anymore, and the buy-to-let is not paying off, and they want to get out now. Two, they've actually been in the game for quite a long time, and they don't want the hassle of buy-to-let anymore because tax positions changed, regulations have changed. Maybe they're not making as much money as they once were. If you can find one of those landlords who's selling up, you could probably get a better price off them than you could do from someone who's just kind of sort of thinking maybe about moving, but like only if we get the right price for our house, and that maybe enables us to get the price for the next house, that kind of thing. Or you look for somebody whose property is up for sale, but they've already found somewhere they want to buy, or they found somewhere they want to buy, they had their property under offer, and then their properties come back on the market. They still really want to buy that property that they were going to buy, and they will accept a lower price off you because that means that they can make their move. So you need to be digging a bit deeper into it. And I would recommend asking the questions of the estate agents. And remember, estate agents act for the person selling the home. But estate agents get paid when they sell houses. It really doesn't make that much difference to an estate agent whether they sell house A for £200,000 or £175,000. Doesn't make a huge difference in the fee that they pick up, the percentage-based fee that they pick up, but it does mean that they still get a fee if they sell it for that lower number. So use that to your advantage, I would say. Don't give up all hope. Keep ploughing on. But unfortunately, it's probably going to take longer than you would have hoped that it would.
Good tips as always, Simon. We've not quite finished with the base rate hold. Want to find out, Helen, if it's all right. Savers, is it all downhill from now on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is broadly downhill. As we talked about before, it's been a real kind of golden age for savers since the base rate started going up. So we've got rates now, even on easy access, past 5%, which is way higher than they've been for years. So savers have really benefited. But now we're seeing the base rate potentially stall. Those real top rates are disappearing from the market. That said, there are still some really good rates out there at the moment. So I think it's kind of crunch time for anyone who's been sort of sitting on their hands and waiting for rates to maybe go higher. Now is really the time to have a look at your savings and decide where the best place to put them is. So we've got, I think, still some deals just over 6% on a 1-year fix. So that's sort of thing that if you can afford to put your money away for that length of time, probably, I think experts would say it's worth kind of grabbing one of those now before things potentially go down. So it's crunch time for savers, I think. Make your mind up, because I think it is probably broadly downhill from here.
Eek. Simon, investors, what about them?
What investors are looking for is interest rates to have peaked. That's the absolutely key thing that everybody is sitting there going, have they peaked? Have they peaked? Can we relax? Have they peaked? Are we going to get any surprises that, oh God, they're going to go up even more? The other thing worrying them is this higher for longer scenario. That's what's been going on over the past month to 6 weeks, right? Where we've had a real stock market wobble driven by government bond yields rising. Bond yields in the US rose substantially with this concern of higher for longer. The interesting thing about the US is the economy is still doing really well there. And the more the economy does well, the more people worry about the fact that the Fed's going to put interest rates up again, and it's not going to have been the peak right now. But even then, they don't think they're going to go up more than maybe one time more or two times more. And that would be really surprising if they went up two times more. But they're worrying about them being higher for longer and the impact that will have. But with the US, it's even more bonkers than the UK, because the transmission method is even weirder there, because most people have very long fixed rate mortgages. So it tends to feed through a bit more to businesses and personal credit than it does to the mortgage market. But you've got the Federal Reserve going about this aggressive run of rate hikes like we've got here. And then you've got the government effectively spending a colossal amount of money with this. It's not called the Green Deal, but it's kind of like a Green Deal where they're doing this huge investment into anything vaguely green technology. So it's boom time in quite a lot of America. And the funny thing about it is, you've got the coastal bits of America, you know, the more populated bits we often talk about. You've got New York, you've got LA, you know, that kind of thing, Miami, whatever, right? Okay. But it's in more in the middle where some of this boom stuff is happening. So in the US, you've got a kind of push and pull at the same time scenario going on. There is the concern rates are going to stay higher for longer. But I think if people readjust to that slowly and think that rates have peaked, then you might start to see a bit more life in the stock market. And if you look at a headline level, the US stock market's done quite well this year, but that's been driven by a relatively small number of companies. If you look at the UK stock market, we've largely been treading water. And again, actually quite a lot of that treading water has been down to a relatively small chunk of relatively large companies. You start looking at the FTSE 250, things look a lot more disturbing. But there are lots of fund managers out there saying, you know, some of the stuff they look at, especially small and mid caps and things like that, look cheap. You know, they're saying this looks cheap. And they're saying we just need the catalyst. We're primed for the bounce back. We just need the catalyst. But they always say that. And it's their job to say that because they want people to invest.
Right. That's it for part one.
Sam North Vitoro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Hello, Sam. How's the last week been? Certainly slightly eventful, hasn't it?
Yeah, very eventful. And you know what? It's been pretty good. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ have surged by more than 5%, closely followed by the Dow, while the DAX and the FTSE have also reported pretty good gains. The week received a boost from a dovish report out of the United States, which led the market to believe that the Federal Reserve has taken significant measures to ensure a soft landing following this jobs report. Furthermore, lower oil prices throughout the week with a decline of over 4% have contributed to some more positive market sentiment. Central bank meetings this week did not deliver any major surprises as the Fed and the Bank of England maintained their previous policies. However, the FOMC meeting was perceived as dovish by the market, resulting in a decline in yields and a resurgence of risk assets. In terms of earnings, over 80% of S&P 500 companies have exceeded estimates during this current earnings season, making it the highest performance since quarter three of 2021. All in all, things are looking better.
It's been that week that me and you have been looking forward to where I can ask you the question and you can tell me that actually things went quite well this week, which hasn't been for a while, has it? But also, it's investors are really looking for that. How do we look set up for next week now that they've digested the rate decisions this week?
Yeah, it's a lot better on a Friday being more positive. We're entering the first full week of November next week. History seems to be on the side of those hoping for a more positive month, despite the negative performance we had in August, in September and October. Interestingly, this marks only the ninth occurrence in history where the S&P 500 has experienced a decline in each of those 3 months in a row. The last two times that happened, 1990 and 2016, which then resulted in a November gain of 6.5%. While there aren't many significant macro events next week, there are a few bits and pieces for us to focus on. Tuesday, the next RBA announcement. We've also got Chinese trade balance data. Wednesday, we'll see the release of the latest minutes from the Bank of Canada. And then on Thursday, we've got Chinese PPI and PPI data. Friday, Veterans Day in the States, which probably will lead to slightly lower market volumes. But it is also essential to watch for the release of the UK GDP figure two, which concludes the week. Additionally, some notable earnings reports from Berkshire Hathaway, Uber, Occidental, Disney, Airbus, Adidas, Roblox, and AstraZeneca. But after a relatively slow start to the week next week, I hope, fingers are crossed, that the positive market momentum can continue.
Fingers crossed, November's the start of a resurgent market. I will catch you next week to find out.
Cheers, Simon. Thank you.
Welcome back. Crane is back on the case, this time the curious case of a misspelt name and over £8,000 in ULEZ fines. Helen, take up the story.
So this is a reader who got in touch. He's a van driver. He lives in the home counties, but he drives into London on a regular basis to work in his van. The story started when he got a letter from ULEZ, which is the ultra low emission zone in London. It's run by TfL, saying he'd made a violation when he'd been driving into London and he owed £354, if that's including sort of late payment charges. He's obviously quite shocked by this. So he rang up the enforcement agents this has been passed on to, and they told him that he actually owed £1,651. And that wasn't even bad enough, because he then contacted TfL and it turned out he had 39 parking charges against this van, which totaled at least £8,400, probably more, because there was 10 that he couldn't even find out how much they cost. He owes loads of money on PCNs, basically. So how did this happen? He bought the van secondhand back in 2021, and he tried to set, you know, you can set up a online account where every time you drive into the ULEZ zone or the congestion charge zone, the payment gets automatically taken from your account. So he tried to set that up, but he couldn't, because whoever owned the van before had previously had an account and they hadn't taken the van off it. Sort of thing that should be quite easy to fix, but it absolutely wasn't. So he called TfL, said, you know, I've got this van, I need to change it to my account so I can pay the ULEZ and congestion charges. They wouldn't tell him who the person was who owned it before. He didn't know, because he bought it from a dealership rather than from an individual. They said because of GDPR, they couldn't tell him who this person was. So he had to track them down himself.
Wow.
Which is obviously quite ridiculous. So it was mad sort of goose chase to find this person who used to own his van. Quite unsurprisingly, he sort of reached a dead end. Now he did kind of make maybe a bit of a mistake here. So he sort of assumed that because the van was registered to him with the DVLA, if there were any charges, they would still eventually come back to him. You know, he'd get a letter to his address and it would be sorted out. But obviously, you know, someone can't spend
that's
their
not a mistake. It. That's a genuinely fair thing to think, no?
I mean, he did. So he said that he just thought payments were still being taken. He kind of wasn't checking his account, but they were.
Well, you know, there's that.
He could have checked that. But I completely agree that, you know, it's you can't spend your entire life chasing down TfL and trying to find a van driver that used to own your van. I mean, that is clearly ridiculous. People have lives. This is further complicated by the fact that he moved house a year or so after he bought this van. So he changed his address, but he set up the redirect. So any post from his old address would go to his new address. That didn't work, because TfL had his name misspelled on their system. And the way that the Royal Mail redirect works is it goes on your name. So if a letter comes in with your old address and your right name, it gets sent to your new address. If it's your old address and an incorrect name, you don't get it. So that's how he missed all of these letters that were being sent to him about these fines. We don't know how this happened. We haven't been able to work it out. He's obviously convinced that he wouldn't misspell his own name when he registered his van with the DVLA. I mean, that makes sense to me. But somewhere along the line, his name has got spelled wrongly. So he missed these 39 PCNs, and that's how he racked up this massive fine. Quite terrifying stuff, really. Just one letter wrong in his name, and it's led to this absolute disaster. So long and short of it, I called TfL and said, come on, he shouldn't have been told to track down this guy himself. There's a silly spelling error. This guy is clearly being kind of charged unfairly here. It's a massive amount of money. I'm really glad to say that they agreed to cut his fine down quite substantially. So instead of paying the £8,400, he's now paying somewhere in the region about £500-600. So they're just asking him to pay for the daily charges that he didn't pay for the congestion charge in ULEZ, which is, I think, £12 and £15 a day. So he's just paying the daily charges. He's not paying any of the fines that he was levied with. So he's just paying for what he's used, which is really good. I'm really glad that I was able to help him and just end this mad saga, because it's clearly been taking up quite a lot of his time over the last
year. I was going to say, how long has this been for him to do it himself, to do it himself, and then you had to get involved? Involvement? How many phone calls, time, emails?
Yeah, he said he thinks he's made at least 20 phone calls. And And the awful thing is as well, when he first spoke to TfL, they said he had to deal with each PCN individually. So they go through different stages. So it starts with TfL and then they pass it on to an enforcement agent. Then it goes to something called the Traffic Enforcement Center. So they're all at different stages. And TfL told him that he couldn't make a kind of bulk payment for all of them. He had to ring up a number for each one of them individually to pay it, which is just absolutely, it's absolutely
despair. Kafka-esque nightmares or worse. Right, thank you very much, Helen. Well done. Now, some of the best investments of the past decade are going cheap. Yes, Simon, I'm coming to you. Simon's been taking a look at an interesting list from the trade body, the Association of Investment Companies. Simon, tell me more.
So, investment trusts, they are a form of investment, but unlike an investment fund, they have two prices because they're traded on the stock market and there's something known as closed-ended, which means that there is a limited number of shares. So they have their share price, which is what you can buy a stake for, and they have their net asset value, which is what that stake that you can buy, that one share that you can buy, is worth. And when investors are feeling very confident or they really, really like trust, those trusts can sometimes go to a premium. People will actually pay more than what it's worth to buy a stake in it. But when investors are feeling pessimistic or they're feeling very, very down on certain sectors or certain types of trust, then it will go to a discount. And discounts are wide at the moment. So the AIC has run a list of the top 20 performing investment trusts of the past 10 years that also trade on double-digit discounts. So these are investment trusts that over the past decade have had an average return of 140%. So over the past 10 years, they've doubled investors' money and then given them some more on top. Another, you know, extra nice big chunk on top of that. But they can be bought on average for 16.1% less than their net asset value. And the simple way of thinking about that is that you can buy into one of those, the average one of those investment trusts, for just 84% of the cost of what it would cost you to go buy all the individual investments that it holds yourself individually. So that's a great deal, doesn't it? And there are some big names on here. It's not just a jumble of junk or stuff that people are a bit dubious of the valuations on, which can often be the case. You have to remember when looking at investment trust discounts to look at what their long-term discount or premium history is, because there are some trusts that just perennially trade on a relatively large discount. There are some that seem to perennially trade on a relatively large premium. And then there are times when they swing around. And there are some in here that have swung around quite a lot. You've got names like Allianz Technology Trust, Polar Capital Technology, and the biggest name of them all in this list is Scottish Mortgage. Scottish Mortgage invests long-term in disruptive businesses, went on a spectacular run through like the kind of financial crisis, post-financial crisis years, through the pandemic. The pandemic, the up in the air. But it's had a torrid time since its peak in November 2021. Its share price has fallen 57%. Also, it holds a sizable number of unlisted companies. So these are companies that aren't traded on the stock exchange, and they can't be priced as easily. So you can't just go, right, well, what's that company worth? What does the market say that company's worth right now? But you do need to bear in mind that Scottish Mortgage tends to invest in larger, established unlisted companies. These are the kind of companies that it invests in because it argues that in a different era, they'd already be on the stock market. But in today's era, companies make it to the stock market much later. It has a fairly robust way of valuing them, but the market in general is very wary of these types of investment trusts right now. Scottish Mortgage is trading on a 17% discount. The discount's actually been bigger in the recent past. But when you look at the fact that for many, many, many years, it was trading on at par or on slight premium, that might make it quite interesting for you. Now, two things to note here. One, I have a holding in Scottish Mortgage, and I should declare that now. And two, the opportunity to buy at a discount doesn't do investors like me much of a favour, who bought at the wrong time and are nursing a 40% loss on the Scottish mortgage shares that they hold. But hey ho, investing's a portfolio game. That's why you don't put all your money in one thing. And luckily I didn't. The thing I'd say about a list like this is it's interesting, and it can be an interesting starting point for, do I think some of these might be an opportunity to invest on the cheap when valuations are low, investors are lacking confidence on the basis that things could improve? I talked about this, you know, in whole investment world, looking at, are we at the peak yet? Are we there yet? Maybe interest rates stop rising. You know, once we get there is, you know, the suggestion that even if we have recession and the stock market don't come at the same time. They don't move in exactly the same way, economies and the stock markets. So you could have a recession and the stock market goes up substantially because the stock market's already pricing in the recession that we're going to have. But use it as a starting point. Do your own research and don't just invest because something's got a big discount. Invest because it's the right investment for you. You rate that manager. The charges aren't too high. It would fit into your portfolio and it suits your risk appetite. And within here, perhaps the greatest story of how dramatic the swing of premiums and discounts can be is an investment trust called Linsell Train. What's that? Linsell Train, particularly large investment trust, run by Michael Linsell and Nick Train, who are two fund managers, and they own the Linsell Train fund management business. Now, Nick Train runs the quite famous Finsbury Growth and Income Trust, this big trust, for example. What's interesting about Linsell Train, which also runs some big funds as well, is that the investment trust has previously traded on a consistently large premium. At one point, it was trading on a 44% premium. So if you wanted to buy a share in Linsell Train Investment Trust, you would be paying 44% more for it than it was theoretically worth, according to the net asset value. You'd have to be totally nuts to do that, wouldn't you? You would think. You'd say, well, why on earth would you do that? Well, people were doing it and supporting that premium because by far the largest holding in that investment trust is a stake in the actual Linsell Train fund management business. And for many years, investors thought that that Linsell Train fund management business was undervalued and that somebody might swoop in, buy the fund management business, you know, at which point the valuation of it would soar. And the investment trust's net asset value would jump. So they thought this is an opportunity to buy in on the cheap. This has swung around somewhat. The trust is now trading on a 13% discount, despite its shares actually having climbed 209% over a decade. So you can see how the narrative can switch around here, and why you need to be careful of this kind of thing.
So in sum, Simon, the moral of this particular story is the same as any story when it comes to investment. It's a bit like going shopping generally. Don't just buy something that's on sale. Do you really want it? Is it going to look good on you? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. Hold it up in the shop. Do the Marie Kondo it. Ask whether it brings you joy.
Exactly right, Simon. Right. Talking about bringing joy. Remember when we were talking about premium bonds and, you know, if you don't have a big holding, well, is there any point? Well, is there any point? Because this month's jackpot winner had just £5,050 holding from May 2000. So this is money wanted to see how this compares to all of the 2023 jackpot winners so far. Helen, what did you find?
Yeah, so anyone who's been browsing the This Is Money website this week might have noticed a lovely picture of Britney Spears in the Oops, I Did It Again video. That's because we had a conversation about what was going on in 2000 when this person bought their £50 premium bond, which has now won them the 1 million jackpot. So this person's been very lucky. Their whole holding was £5,050. As I said, the bond that won £50 bought in May 2000. I think this is the kind of dream that people think of when they buy premium bonds, isn't it? You know, I could, in theory, I could put in a relatively small amount and win really big. And in this case, that has happened. It's a return of nearly 20,000% on their investment in premium bonds. So not too shabby at all. However, we decided to have a look at how likely that is to happen and what the other winners so far in 2023 have had invested. And unfortunately, this person is quite a rare case. So far this year, out of the 22 jackpot prizes, 9 have been won by those holding the maximum of £50,000 in premium bonds, although 3 have been won with holdings under £10,000. The person who won with the lowest holdings so far this year was in February, when someone scooped the 1 million prize with a £3,000 holding, which was bought in February 2028. But this bond bought in 2000 is the oldest bond so far this year to take the 1 million prize. So I suppose it shows that, you know, it sometimes can pay to hold on to your premium bonds in the hope that you'll win big. But unfortunately, it is a bit of an outlier. The odds of winning on premium bonds for any prize are still 21,000 to 1 for each individual bond. So it's a nice story. Absolutely a joy for this person, but yeah, they've still been very lucky.
Yeah. Opportunity to put a picture of Brittany, which I totally missed there, which goes to show how good online advertising clearly isn't for me, because I don't notice a woman in a red latex outfit. Simon, your thoughts on premium bonds, not red latex outfits?
I don't think that picture of Britney Spears looks that much like Britney Spears.
Well, that's why I got a bit confused, I think, in my defense.
Picture. I think if it had been the, you know, one of the other pictures, then it would have been more obvious, more obviously her.
Okay, thanks.
Was that what you wanted to ask me about? Did you want to ask me?
No, nothing to do with her outfit, just what you thought about premium bonds and the fact that, you know, it sort of goes counter to what we were saying the other day, that if you don't have a fair bit in it, don't bother. We didn't really say that, but we, you know, I'm just paraphrasing massively.
I mean, this isn't just a build up to the worst podcast quiz of all time, where our poor listeners have to listen to us try and guess the 2000s pop star from the photograph of them that they can't actually see when they're listening to the podcast, is it? I mean, we could play that
game.
Do you want to set that up for next week?
I think we should.
Email into us if you'd really like to play a game of guess the pop star when you can't actually see the pop star.
We could describe it.
In fact, for the Christmas special, we'll publish a special article with pictures of pop stars so people can just look at it at the same time as listening and see whether they can guess them along with us. I love the fact that the person who won the jackpot with the £3,000 premium bond in February bought that bond in February 2008. That's got to have been one of the best investments anybody made in February 2008. Yes. The world was a miserable place in February 2008. We were mid financial crisis. Everyone was freaking out. Somebody went, I'll put £3,000 in the premium bonds. And then, does the maths, 15 years later, lo and behold, they get a ring on the doorbell. Who's that? Because we're parcel. I'm going to go to the door and it's going to be an Amazon driver running away again, isn't it? I wonder whether I'll actually get them this time or whether they'll be in the van speeding off down the road to play knockdown parcel ginger on somebody else. And they get to the door and it turns out there's actually somebody standing there and they don't recognize them. And they say, excuse me, are you Mr. or Mrs. Bloggs? Whichever one they are, or, you know. We don't know they were called Blogs. It'd be a turn up for the books, wouldn't it, if the winner in February was actually called Blogs? And they say, yeah, I am. Who are you? Where's my parcel?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The person on the doorstep says, I've got some news for you. Could I come in?
God is risen? Like, no.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. No, I'm not signing up.
Yeah, exactly, right?
And then eventually they managed to convince them to let them in. I don't think they told them on the doorstep. We've done interviews before.
Did they actually have to come in the house? There's a whole security issue thing here.
The mysterious Agent Million.
Yeah.
The mysterious Agent Million. And Agent Million says, I've got some good news for you. You've won the premium bonds. Really? What? £1 million? Wow. And they're overjoyed. And then they tell them it was with that bond that they bought in February 2008. I don't know if they do that on the day that they turn up. We're making this up because it's a mystery. Yeah. So we can make up.
It's nice. It's a nice story.
Yeah. Yeah. And they say to them, you can only have your £1 million if you manage to guess correctly all 10 of these pop stars from 2008.
We'd be fine, though, wouldn't we, Simon?
They made the best investment of 2008 in February that year with their £3,000 bond, but they were also a massive 2008 top 40 music charts fan. It was the days before streaming, so people paid more attention to it, and they get the money. And, you know, now we're looking at it, what, 9 months later, aren't we? And they're, you know, probably sitting there somewhere listening to the This Is Money podcast and thinking, how did they know exactly what happened when Adrian Million turned up?
Yeah. I mean, that could have happened, Simon, I think. It could have happened. All I'm now thinking is, if someone came up at my door and said, you've won the money, can I come in the house? I'd be like, call the police. But anyway, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into. And also, Simon, I think now's a good time to advertise your good selves on a little TV show that you've got going on This Is Money. So do make sure that you regularly watch that. Simon?
Oh, yes. If you like this podcast, then come and watch our new video show twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, Lunch Money. You can find it on This Is Money's YouTube channel. The way to find that is to Google This Is Money YouTube. Or you can find it on the site, obviously, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And yeah, come and watch it. It's a quick 10-minute roundup of the day's important financial and business news. Tells you what you need to know. But keep listening to the podcast, though. Do keep listening to the podcast. Don't swap one for the other. Just do both.
Okay? And it's better when you're driving as well to listen to the podcast. I wouldn't recommend watching sort of video content when you're driving.
No, that's illegal.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if you do want to contact us, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, particularly if Agent Million has ever turned up on your doorstep and you want to tell us in confidence what actually happens and whether you have to guess pop stars from when you bought the bond or not. Or you can tweet us at This Is Money, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
Do you know what, Simon? Sorry, it just made me think. I first bought my premium bonds about 2 months ago. I don't think I could tell you the pop stars 2 months ago as well as I could tell you the pop stars in 2008. Does anyone know? I'm out.
It's easier
Beyonce,
Taylor Swift. It's easier to do now because of the fact that streaming means that it's just loads of like old songs, old people. That
you right. In the charts?
I don't mean to be rude saying that you only recognise old people, but...
it's all right, Simon. Fine. That's it. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.